This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, from the Department of Geography, Geology, and the Environment at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to Emily O'Gorman, author of Wetlands in a Dry Land, More Than Human Histories of Australia's Murray-Darling Basin, published this year by the University of Washington Press. Dr. O'Gorman, welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
So to start off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you came to write this book?
Sure. So I'm speaking to you from where I live, which is in the Sydney region in the Blue Mountains, which is Darug and Gundungurra country. It's the country of the Darug and Gundungurra Aboriginal people. And so this area, the Blue Mountains, is part of a mountain range in eastern Australia from which water runs into the rivers of the Murray-Darling Basin, which is the focus of the book that we're talking about and that I've written. So I just would like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of this country and also to acknowledge that the basin is comprised of the country of 40 different Aboriginal groups. And I also pay my respects to elders past and present. So I'm a senior lecturer at Macquarie University in Sydney, which is on Darug country. And I've worked with and within the Murray-Darling River system for quite a long time now, all up more than 15 years. I've actually written another book about it, quite a different book actually. And this is my second book about this area. It's a big place. It's the seventh of Australia, covering quite a number of states in eastern Australia, and it's got a really rich diversity of landscapes and people, which has sort of kept me working in the region and kept me thinking about what this region has to offer our understandings of history, of water, and so on. So it's also a region that's rich in environmental contestations, many of which happen between multiple scales, from international to quite local, and I pick up on some of these different contestations within the book, but also areas of cooperation between different groups, particularly around wetlands and water. So I wrote this book, as I said, it's the second book I've written about this region, and in some ways it reflects my changing interests and also my changing thinking in relationship to that first book, and also my continued, I guess, learning. As an academic, we're in this lucky position where we can keep on learning all the time. And I started working, I'm a historian by background, so did a PhD in history. And then my first book was based on that PhD. It's about changing understandings of floods in this same river system. And the first job I got out of my PhD was a postdoc, which was in an interdisciplinary centre called the Australian Centre for Cultural and Environmental Research at the University of Wollongong. And that had a lot of geographers in it. And this close engagement with geographers changed my thinking, I would say, and made me think about the value of history in a different sort of way, but also what historians might learn from interdisciplinary environmental conversations, from the work happening in geography. So this book sort of has its roots in that thinking, which was a while ago. And all of this kept percolating in my mind as I continued to do smaller projects in the basin. And then I decided to write this book about wetlands that tries to bring some of these things together. So I guess the book at its core, it's a history of wetlands within this particular river system, the Murray-Darling Basin in Australia. But it aims to show what this region can contribute to international discussions about history in relation to other fields, in relation to interdisciplinary conversations happening around more than human studies, more than human scholarships, multi-species studies, and also international discussions about water and wetlands in this time of environmental crisis. So it's quite different from my first book, and it's sort of quite explicitly positioned in a fairly interdisciplinary space, while still looking at history. So it's trying to bring history into this interdisciplinary space in a different sort of way, I suppose.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate the shout out to Wollongong there. I spent a semester there many years ago, and they've got a lot of good geographers.
They do. They certainly do. Yeah.
Okay. So the subtitle to your book uses this term more than human. And so that's a pretty clear indication of where you're placing yourself in the field of theories about human-environment relationships. But just to get all of our listeners up to speed, could you tell us what more than human means and why you think this is a productive approach for understanding the Murray-Darling Basin?
Sure. How can we distill more than human approaches? So I guess in essence, these are a set of approaches that have developed over the last couple of decades through a transdisciplinary dialogue. Transdisciplinary dialogue includes scholars from anthropology, geography, really important science and technology studies, particularly feminist science and technology studies, philosophy, and a range of other fields. And so through this dialogue, the dialogue has shaped a set of interdisciplinary concerns that cluster around this this concept of more than human scholarship and approaches, and I guess related to that, multi-species studies, they have a lot in common, I would say. So in general terms, this scholarship, this interdisciplinary scholarship, rejects notions of human exceptionalism that have sort of developed within Western traditions, and that have helped to create a separation within Western traditions between nature and culture. And this division and separation and hyper-separation of nature and culture has at various times come to justify human exploitation of what has been framed as an externalized nature. So instead, these more than human approaches argue for a richer examination of socio-ecological relationships, and that's really important, thinking of these things together, the social and the ecological, the political and the ecological. But this can be encapsulated in the term socio-ecological, so that these richer examinations can more fully account for a diversity of actors, and importantly, that's a diversity of both human and non-human actors. So really core to these more than human approaches and multi-species approaches is diversity and multiplicity on lots of different levels, and thinking about human diversity as well as non-human diversity. So one of the really important aspects of these approaches, I think, particularly in the way that I have been engaging with them, and I think that's really valuable for historians as well, is that there's an emphasis on situating, shifting modes of understanding. So it's about the way knowledges change over time, but also are situated within particular power relationships within particular cultural dynamics, sets of values and so on, and that these shifting modes of understandings have been used to make sense of and inhabit these relationships and so help to co-create the worlds that emerge from these more than human relationships. So I think this is really useful for historians, for everyone perhaps engaging with these more than human approaches, is to think about the emphasis that these approaches put on shifting modes of understanding that have been formed within specific histories, cultures, and more than human relationships, and that they've had particular consequences.
Okay. Yeah, I think that all comes through pretty well in your book. So I asked you first question about the subtitle. Now I want to ask you about the main title of the book. It's called Wetlands in a Dry Land. So how does it shape the situation that these areas that you're talking about, these are areas that have a lot of water to them, but they're within a continent that's known for being primarily a desert or arid area?
The Murray-Darling Basin is a really fascinating place, and water in this basin and then the role of wetlands is really fascinating as well. So this is a region that's shaped by droughts and floods. Dry times are sort of more common, I suppose. Droughts are not unusual in this region. But then there's these periods, these wetter years, where the river system floods. And within this dynamic of droughts and floods, wetlands play a really interesting role. So wetlands during drier years are often refuges for animals because they hold water for longer, often depending on the severity of the drought. And I guess in the context of climate change, they're playing a really interesting role where droughts are becoming longer, more intense, and the wetlands are in many cases drying out. So they're changing into more terrestrial ecosystems, I guess, in those drier periods, which is causing all sorts of problems. So I guess another motivation in writing this book is that current context of climate change, where wetlands are, the role of wetlands is changing, I suppose, and wetlands are changing under this anthropogenic climate change. And I guess I should also emphasise that the context of this book is the loss of wetlands over, not just in this area, but around the world over the last 300 years, up to 80% of wetlands, as an estimate that ecologists have given, up to 80% of wetlands around the world have been lost due to drainage for urban development, due to water diversions for agriculture, and a whole range of reasons. And most of those wetlands have been lost in the 20th century. So when we think about the 20th century, this is a period in which many large dams have been built, many countries invested in large irrigation schemes. And you think about that post-war era of nation building in many places where all of these projects were really coming into their own. Governments were investing in these as labour schemes for a whole range of reasons. All this concern about food security and so on. So the Murray-Darling Basin is interesting because it reflects those international trends in terms of losses of wetlands. It's a region that has lost a lot of wetlands. It's also a region where in the 20th century there was a lot of emphasis by the federal or national government as well as the state government in developing irrigation areas and building large dams. There's 105 large dams in the basin. So that's dams that with 10 metre or over crest height. So there's a lot of dams here. There's extensive irrigation areas, and that they really took off in the 20th century. So that's a focus of my book as well. So wetlands in a dry land, it's about, in terms of thinking about this place, it's about this place is has a lot of things that are really unique that I think the world can learn from, particularly as we head into climate change futures, including issues of water scarcity and how wetlands are changing under those dynamics, but also have changed in the past. This is a place that experienced droughts and floods for a long, long time. But also it speaks to international trends. So it's got this, it's both unique and also reflective of some of those global trends as well.
Yeah, that always makes for a good book when it's unique, but also links to these larger questions.
Yeah, I think sometimes when we're writing, and I know this from my own work, and also thinking about national histories more generally, there is this tendency to point out the uniqueness without linking it to the global trends. But there, I mean, you know, there are all of these links happening all the time. We're in this, in this interesting space where there's the tension or the connections between the local and the global, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah. So then I want to ask about the structure of the book, because this is not kind of a comprehensive overview, total history of the whole basin. It's more a series of case studies of specific places and times. And each one has a chapter with an action word for a title, like leaking and infecting. And so I'm curious why you took this approach and how you went about selecting these cases to focus in on for each of these chapters.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for that question. So there's so many different ways I decided to structure it this way, and I'll try and unpack some of those and try and distill them as well. So I guess one aspect is that in engaging with more than human approaches and bringing them into conversation with environmental approaches in environmental history as a field, one of the things that more than human approaches really emphasize, and when we think about situated knowledges, is that the grand narrative, it tries to break away from a grand narrative, from something that has a sort of a sense of a overarching history that tries to be totalizing in some sense. Like, it's not about this is the history of wetlands in this area. This is a history that is, and it's sort of trying to situate this as this book as coming from a particular set of perspectives and a particular set of approaches. It's trying to situate, I guess, myself and my approaches in relation to the basin. So it's trying to get away from a sense that this is the history, which I don't think many historians these days would claim explicitly. But in taking this structure, I'm trying to make that really clear, I suppose. So rather than having in the beginning, this is what happened, and then this is all the things that happened, this is the end, I'm taking a more sliced approach. So that situatedness is really clear. The other reason I wanted to take a thematic approach is because throughout the book I'm really interested in a dialogue between the past and the present. So each chapter is about engaging in that dialogue. So it's not just the final chapter that brings this book up to the present. Each chapter is a dialogue between historical episodes and encounters, a human and non-human encounters, in relation to the present as well. So I wanted to keep that dialogue going, and I think also particular chapters try and engage with different sorts of temporalities as well. And so having that really simplified or traditional narrative structure didn't work for some of the material I was engaging with. So I'm thinking particularly of the first chapter, which is a written really in conversation with three Aboriginal women from around the basin. And I wanted to engage with, the different temporalities happening in our conversations, and particularly in engaging with their weaving practices. I wanted to bring out different sorts of temporalities. So that's one reason, or that's maybe two reasons. So another reason that I've ended up with these particular themes is that actually when I was first starting this book, and this was quite a long time ago, probably about 5 or 6 years ago, when I was first thinking about this book and sketching out a chapter structure, I actually had the structures the chapters structured around particular animals or plants. So that was my idea, that each chapter would engage with particular animals and plants. And I was then at the Rachel Carson Center for Environment and Society in Munich, which is a wonderful place where scholars from around the world gather who are in the environmental humanities. And I was workshopping this structure with some people, and one person in particular, Celia Lowe, an anthropologist in the US, or from the US, then at the Carson Center, said, I think the more important thing here is processes, and maybe think about structuring your book around processes. And this stayed with me. So I continued, and I didn't want to give up the animal plant structure. So I kept thinking, well, how can I bring these together? Should I focus on processes? Should I focus on particular animals and plants? And I kept thinking about it, kept reading and developing my thinking about more than human approaches and scholarships. And of course, scholarship in that field kept happening and moving on. And so I thought, well, I think the best way for me to structure this is actually around concepts and processes that draw attention to sets of relationships, because more than human approaches are really about sets of relationships. It's not about the humans and non-humans. It's about more than human sets of relationships that include humans and non-humans. So that's why I decided on a set of these terms. The process of deciding which terms in specifically was long and dynamic. So, and these changed over time as I kept working and I kept refining them, kept talking to people in the basin as well. So I ended up, for example, focusing one of the chapters on the enclosing of wetlands as I talked more to Aboriginal people in the basin about issues of access to wetlands. And so that is how that took shape, and that was sort of in dynamic relationship with people I was speaking to, with the archives I was working on. It was a long process of refining them. And it was also, I see it as sort of as, I also focused on some terms that I thought were sort of under-emphasized in the work I was reading about this region that I thought was really important, and also in thinking about wetlands generally. So I guess, we were talking about the connections between the local and the global and everything on that spectrum. So you've got a whole range of scales happening there. And I tried to focus on terms that drew attention to those sets of connections as well, that were relevant not only to what was happening in the basin, and they all are, but also that were relevant to histories and futures, I think, too, of wetlands more generally in many places. So it was a dynamic process of refining my thinking about these terms, and it actually took a long time, and some of them were changing right up to right up to the submission of the manuscript. Maybe I shouldn't say that, but it was, I thought very carefully, I should say, about these terms.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay. So to give you, to give our listeners a little bit of a taste of what some of these more in-depth case study chapters are like, I want to ask you a very important question, which is, do ducks eat rice? And why is that such a complicated and controversial question in the Murray-Darling Basin?
Do ducks eat rice? Well, it depends on who you ask. So ducks are really interesting in the basin. I think they're deceptively simple folks, and I say that because I don't think they are simple, but I think they're so common that people overlook them. They're actually quite complex, interesting characters. So ducks in the basin, one of the many reasons they're interesting is that they're not migratory, I should say. A lot of ducks around the world are migratory. The ducks in North America are migratory, at least many of them, in my understanding. And in Australia, because of these changes in dry and wet conditions, the ducks, instead of following seasons, they follow the water around. So they go to where the water is. So their ecologists call them nomadic rather than migratory. And so one of the places the ducks followed water to was the rice growing areas in the Murrumbidgee Irrigation Area, which is in the basin. It's the Murrumbidgee River is part of the Murray River system, and it's the irrigation areas in New South Wales, the state and of New South Wales. And rice started to be grown in that irrigation area in the 1920s. And ducks started turning up in these rice fields really quickly. The first year rice was grown there. And rice, of course, the varieties that were being grown there, were grown in flooded bays. So they almost created this sort of wetland environment. And, you've got rice there, which is semi-aquatic plants. And so the ducks come in and they are attracted to these fields or attracted to these places because there's nesting material and there's potentially food. But there is this controversy about whether ducks were actually eating the rice. So soon after the ducks turned up, the farmers started noticing damage in their crops, and they asked the state government to investigate whether the ducks were causing this damage and also whether they were eating rice. So some farmers said that they saw ducks eating rice, and the state government investigated, basically. And actually there were a series of investigations spanning from the 1920s right through. I think there were still some investigations happening in the 1980s, and this controversy sort of has kept going. So the controversy is really that the people doing the investigations, the scientists who were different scientists across this series of years, claimed that the ducks weren't doing this damage. And in fact, one of the scientists doing the earliest investigation thought that the farmers were force-feeding ducks rice and sending them off to Sydney to his offices where he would dissect them. So he thought it was that the farmers knew that the ducks weren't eating rice, but were wanting a special open season on ducks in the area, so that they could get hunters up from Victoria who would pay then to hunt the ducks on the rice growing area. So it's quite a complicated set of circumstances. The farmers were adamant that ducks were doing damage. And later on, many of the farmers were new to farming. They were recruited from the state government to come to this irrigation area to start farms, but they often had very little farming experience. And it's a part of a much bigger history in Australia about getting people from particular backgrounds, particularly European people, onto small-scale farms, which would have a sort of civilizing benefit. But they often didn't have farming backgrounds. So as the farmers got more experience and new irrigation areas sprung up, in some of those newer irrigation areas later on, those farmers started saying ducks were doing damage. But in the more established farms where farmers had more experience, the ducks weren't such an issue anymore. And so this question comes out about, well, maybe it was the farming practices. So one of the ideas was that if you sow a field as a farmer, or a paddy rather, but the paddy's not even, or you haven't sown the rice grains properly, you'll get poor germination, which creates areas where there's no rice, which means the ducks come and settle there because there's open space, and then they keep swimming in the paddy and push the other rice down. But one of the other things in terms of ducks eating rice is farmers wrote testimonials to the scientists saying from the earliest times of concern that they were having over ducks doing damage, that the water was spreading across the rice bays, and ducks were in front of the water eating the rice grains and so on. So there's these eyewitness accounts of ducks eating grains. The scientists thought the ducks were being blamed for damage that other birds were actually doing. They thought that the crows were actually eating the rice. So it's very, it's very hard to know. I can't answer that question of whether ducks eat rice or not because there's very different accounts, and it's one of the really interesting controversies around ducks. And it continues. You know, there are still special open seasons declared on ducks in these areas with the idea that they're damaging rice. So it's a damaging rice crop. So it's a it's an ongoing set of issues, I would say.
Yeah, I feel like we sometimes learn the most about a situation and the full system when there is a basic question like, are the ducks eating the rice, that we can't answer. But we see how everybody goes about trying to answer it and what the effects of those attempted answers are.
I should say that, these attempted answers created huge archives, which is basically what I draw on in the book. And it's sort of part of the reason the book started, is that I was researching the use of water and histories of uses of water in rice growing in these areas. And there were these massive archives on water and rice growing, but there were just as big a files on ducks in these areas. So that piqued my interest, I suppose, thinking, well, what's going on with these ducks here? And So in a lot of ways that led me down the path into this book. And how can we explain these sets of relationships and these controversies and these situated different knowledges that are bound up in cultural and political contexts as well? And they change over time, those contexts, of course.
All right. So to shift focus a little bit, your book really foregrounds the role of Indigenous Australians and their relationship to country. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how you went about positioning yourself in relationship to the Indigenous communities and nations that live in the areas that you're writing about.
Sure. So I have been incredibly lucky to meet some really wonderful people in the course of this research, and that includes, and really importantly includes, a bunch of really wonderful Aboriginal women who, I should say, are really crucial to the way this book has taken shape. So I guess in terms of positioning, I have learnt a lot. Is my positioning is one of learning, and I've learned a lot from the Aboriginal women who I've met, and also the Aboriginal men I've met as well. So in the course of writing this book, I was travelling to particular areas and meeting people, and over the course of that time, I formed relationships with people and made friends with people, in fact, including Aboriginal people who I then have written some chapters in conversation with in different ways. And as I have said, have sort of informed the approach to the book overall. So there's so many. How can I answer this question? Because I feel like it's been so crucial and important to this book. Some of the people and the conversations I've had with them. So perhaps to give an example, one of the Aboriginal women who has been really important to this book is Danielle Carney-Flakler, who's a Welwyn woman whose country includes the beautiful Macquarie Marshes, which is part of the Darling River system. And we first met, and have known of Danielle for a long time because she has been really senior in different water management positions in New South Wales and in Aboriginal cultural heritage positions in New South Wales as well. And environmental conservation. So I've known of her for a really long time, and there was a conference happening at Macquarie University on wetlands, and myself and someone else organising a session, my co-organiser, we invited Danielle to come and talk about some of the work she was doing out at the Macquarie Marshes in terms of cultural burning of the wetlands. Which needed to happen in concert with dam releases, water releases from dams, which flow down to the marshes. So we invited her to come and speak. And following the conference, which included environmental scientists as well, and was in fact run by environmental scientists, who work on the Macquarie Marshes. So a group of us who had been at the conference went to the marshes. So Danielle had come to Sydney to give this talk, and then we were going to her country. And she came and met us and spoke to us about the marshes and told us so much about the Welwyn history of the area. And that was a really wonderful experience, very privileged experience to listen to Danielle. And through that, we started a conversation. So I Danielle and my conversations, particularly about weaving with sedges from the marshes, is a really strong aspect of the first chapter, which focuses on weaving, but also picks up issues of access to wetlands, water politics of wetlands, but also intergenerational knowledge and so on. So that's really important to that chapter. But that chapter is one part of a bigger set of conversations Danielle and I are having. So we're also working on another project, which is about Whalewyn women's knowledge, which Danielle had already initiated and was bringing me in as a historian to think or to revisit colonial archives and see what is in there, reading against the grain, rereading colonial archives for Whalewyn women's knowledges. So I guess, yeah, so my engagement with Aboriginal people in the basin is one of learning, it's of reciprocity, and this book is one part of a whole lot of other things that I'm doing with and collaborations that I'm having. So yeah, I don't know if that completely answers your question, Stentor.
Yeah, I think that's good. And so I think we've given our listeners a pretty good idea of what to expect if they pick up this book. So I'd like to close out our interview by asking you what you're working on next. What kind of projects are you taking up now that this book is out?
So I guess I've already hinted at some of that, which is through this book I have started or become involved in, co-created a bunch of collaborations with different people. So that includes collaborating with Danielle. It also includes a collaboration with some colleagues at Macquarie University who are geographers, environmental scientists at the University of Canberra, and Gomeroi Kamilaroi custodians whose country includes the Gwaida wetlands. And we're doing a collaboration that's really centered on enabling healthier country in Gomeroi Kamilaroi country, focusing on the Gwaida wetlands and a few other sites as well. And that project has been co-created and is being led really by Gomeroi Kamilaroi custodians. So along with those collaborative projects, I am starting into the next big sort of book project as well, which is going to focus on, and this may change, of course, is going to focus on international wetlands conservation. So one of the things I became really interested in while I was working on this book is post-war environmental and wetlands conservation. And just to background that, one of the things I looked into while I was doing this book is this category of wetlands. How, because as I was reading through this book, reading through the archives and reading through various sources, I was noticing, you know, that wetlands only starts to emerge as a term really in the international arena in the 60s and 70s. It's used a little longer in the US, but it gathers this international usage in the second half of the 20th century and is laden with values of conservation. So this idea of, or this concept and category of wetlands is really about reframing, you know, swamps, marshes and so on as these miasmic places into wetlands, which are places worth conserving. So I've become really interested in this post-war era of wetlands conservation, and particularly why did wetlands become a focus of international environmental conservation? What is it about them that made them be taken up in these international arenas? So that is what I'm starting into.
All right. Well, we will be looking forward to that in the coming years here. So, Dr. O'Gorman, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, Thinta.
You just heard a conversation with Emily O'Gorman, author of Wetlands in a Dryland, More Than Human Histories of Australia's Murray-Darling Basin, published this year by the University of Washington Press.